Hello, everyone, and welcome to the latest edition of the Packers Podcast. I'm Michael Cohen, here as always with fellow beat writer Bob McGinn, but we have a new location today. We are no longer recording over on your neck of the woods there on the other side of the stadium. We are east of the river by about, what, 100 yards? 100 yards east of the river here, Bob?
Yep, the Mighty Fox.
And you found your way to my humble abode here on North Washington Street. What are your first impressions of the Casa de Mike?
You're in a high rise here, Mike, on Washington Street, the main thoroughfare of downtown Green Bay, the street where victorious Packer championship teams from the 20s, 30s, and 40s would be paraded down Washington Street. You are seven blocks north of the Packer administrative building down at the other end of Washington Street, where they moved out of there in 1956, maybe? You would know after taking the HOF tour.
Yes.
57,
yes. 1956,
perhaps?
56, 57, the year after my parents were born.
Okay, yeah. And we're above the Hagemeister Brewing Company, I guess?
Yeah, it's right next door. It's the next building over, right here on the city walk, city deck, rather. So it's a nice little spot. It's a nice little spot. Well, in today's paper, we had a little bit of news there, Bob. You had a nice story on Mr. Mike Daniels, a key defensive line player for the Green Bay Packers, who missed a big portion of this camp so far with an injury, but he's back. But that's not the news we're talking about. Tell us what's going on with Mr. Daniels.
Yeah, the Packers, under Ted Thompson and Russ Ball, his right-hand man, they've always targeted one of their prospective UFA, unrestricted free agents, to try to re-sign before the start of training camp, or at the very least before the start of the regular season, entering the last year of his deal. Daniels, of their 14 UFAs to be, was targeted this year. The two sides talked a lot, and several months ago, up to fairly recently, but there was quite a gulf between the two sides, and it just broke off, and my assumption is it'll be revisited after the season, but maybe not before. Sources have said that the Packers are, Daniels, his opening, he's looking for about $10 million a year, and the Packers are somewhere south of that. So that's where they're at. Daniels is their best interior pass rusher. You could call him their best defensive lineman. He's a young guy. He's a tremendous locker room presence, totally committed to the franchise, great workout guy, family guy. I mean, he's got all that stuff. He's got everything going. He's strong. He's up to 312. But the one problem he has is he's 6'0" 1/2". So he's a shorter player. That hasn't hurt his production here in Green Bay, but that might be a factor in negotiations for a big deal.
Do you think that $10 million figure is at all reasonable, or is that a player just sort of reaching for the stars a bit?
You know, it's hard to say the way the salary cap goes up, Mike. I mean, you look at previous deals, but you know this money's going higher every year. And for Daniels, it would be like a 4 or 5 year deal. Well, this thing could be undervalued three, four years from now with this increase in salaries, additional TV deals. I mean, who knows where this money's going? So you got to reach higher, and $10 million might sound higher to a normal listener right now, but it may not be. I mean, let's look at a few deals. You know, right before the 2013 season, the Bengals gave Geno Atkins, another fourth-round pick like Daniels, interior pass rusher like Daniels, plays in a 4-3, not a 3-4. Atkins is 6'1.5". They gave him big money. The number was 10.7 million per year and about 15 million in guarantees. Everybody said, "Holy smokes!" You know, how, when this thing was signed, and the agent in the football business, they could not believe those numbers. Unfortunately for Atkins, he blew out his ACL a few months after that. Came back last season, didn't play well. But, I mean, that's all, you know, beside the point. I mean, the Bengals paid him that money. Now, there's two things about when the Bengals were going on when they did that deal. Number one, they hadn't paid Andy Dalton yet, so they didn't have that albatross on their salary cap. And number two, you got to pay a certain amount of money, of your cap money, to players, and the Bengals are notoriously cheap, shall we say. And they had to pay somebody, and they elected to pay Atkins, who had had – how many sacks? He had had 23 sacks and was a two-year starter in his first 3 years. Just like Daniels, he was entering his fourth year. So that's a comparable, of course, that Brian Mackler and Daniels will use. But then there's been others now in the last 2 to 3 months that are rather eye-opening. These guys are all 3-4 ends and in a similar scheme to Green Bay. They're all entering. They had 5-year original deals as first-round picks in each case, whereas Daniels was a fourth. And here's the numbers they got. In June, Corey Leggett, 18 sacks in 4 years, a really good interior rusher like Daniels, 10.25 million average, 30.5 guaranteed.
Wow.
Okay, a little bit after that, I think it was in July, Cameron Jordan, first-round pick from the Saints, 29 sacks in 4 years. He gets 11 million average with 33.5 guaranteed. Now, just for one comparison, Ndamukong Suh in March, he got, it was 59.9 guaranteed, 6 years, 114 mil. So that's about 20 million a year. Now, the other one then is Cameron Hayward, who's really doesn't have nearly the pass rush of Leggett or Daniels, and not as much as Jordan either. Hayward's kind of a stay-at-home five technique for the Steelers. We saw him last Sunday. He's got 15 sacks in 4 years. He gets 10.5 average. Again, the deal is not nearly as good. He only 15 mil guaranteed. So when you look at Daniels, his request is certainly not outlandish. Now, it's open for debate, which the Packers are doing, but it is not outrageous by any means. The Packers currently are $15.5 million under the cap. That's the eighth most room of any team in the league. They can do whatever they want, Mike. Ted Thompson, Russ Ball, Mark Murphy, they can allocate anything. They've always done a terrific job, and it's an under-publicized area of their regime. They do a heck of a job on that salary cap. Russ Ball primarily is to be commended for that, as Andrew Brandt was before as his predecessor. So they can do whatever they want. Right now they don't want to do it with Daniels.
Some guys like to talk about their contract situations and they think it can help them leverage. Other guys choose to stay quiet. I saw you talking to Mr. Daniels in the locker room yesterday. What was his approach to that?
Matter of fact, he's a really bright guy, and he knows what's going on. Of course he knows what's going on. He didn't hire Mackler to do it by himself in a vacuum. He knows everything that's going on. Every player does. They'd be pretty stupid if they let some guy deal with them and they were in absentia. So, but Daniel said he loves playing in Green Bay. He's got a couple kids. His wife, they make their home in Green Bay. He's here all the time. He's a poster boy for the franchise. He's a hard-charging, violent leader, motivator, inspirational character. You've been around him a little bit, Mike. Everybody respects this guy in that locker room.
And not only that, but he bonds really well with his coach, Mike Turgovac, because they both have a history of being wrestlers growing up. So they bond really well in that area. And he's able to sort of lead the defense by example on that defensive line because he sort of mimics the exact style that Turgovac wants.
Mm-hmm. So, Mike, So Daniels didn't do any politicking for himself, and he really didn't get in a whole lot, you know. That's kind of the way players are nowadays. There was a time, as recently as 15 years ago, I'd say, and then and back to when I got on the beat 30-plus, a player, to get good money from the Packers, you had to hold out once in your life. That's at the point of your – when you had leverage and you were a good player – you had to hold out. And these holdouts would last 30, 40, 50 days sometimes. They all did it. It was just a fact of beat life. You were talking to that player and or his agent almost every day. You could have, it could be August 15th, camp gone on for 3 weeks. You might still be dealing with 6 holdouts, 4 holdouts. This is just, it's all changed and for the better. Believe me, readers would not want to go back to those days, nor would the writers writing about all that stuff constantly.
No, I can't say that sounds like a very fun time in the dog days of August to be missing four of your better players that you have a chance to watch and practice and to be constantly on the phone with agents.
Well, let's call Rich Moran's agent. No, it's time to call Brian Noble's. No, Ken Rutgers. You know, on and on it went. Everybody held out.
Well, I guess we have to talk about the obvious topic, which is the major loss of Jordy Nelson. number one wide receiver for the Packers, who suffered a torn ACL in the second exhibition game against the Steelers. Sort of a fluke play where he just ran a little route out to the sideline, curled back, jumped to catch a pass, landed, and it looked like he just blew a tire, basically. He sort of went to turn to his left, crumbled to the ground, and his season was over, Bob.
Yeah, now you... Let's talk about what we just saw the other day now, okay, Mike? So we were, Tom Silverstein, you and me, we were discussing whether Jordy would talk about his injury before he had surgery. And we didn't think he would, did we?
Not really. I mean, there were basically two ways he could have gone about it. He could have gotten it out of the way before the surgery and just said, okay, I'll talk to the reporters, I'll explain everything, and then they won't see me until, you know, everything started to heal and everything like that. The other way would be for him to just sort of vanish and disappear for, you know, 3 weeks or a month until he has that surgery and then speak to us afterwards. But to Jordy's credit, he got up there and spoke to us for 12 minutes, which is longer than a lot of players might have spoken. And he basically answered every question. He was in good spirits, and he got everything out of the way and done. So it was kind of an impressive display, I think, to see how quickly he had changed his mindset from the negative, which he said really haunted him for that first 36 hours. He said he was in a pretty bad place, couldn't really even bring himself to talk to his teammates. And then by the time we got to the facility on Tuesday morning, he was smiling, he was laughing, he had said that he'd come to peace with it, and he was ready for the next season.
Yeah. You covered that. I listened into it for a little bit. It was interesting. Over time, when guys have had big injuries. Now, Raji did not speak last year, BJ. He waited, I don't even know. I mean, a month after surgery, it seems like he was in the locker room. So, okay, I applaud Jordy for doing it. You know, just moving on now. He moves on, we move on. And it provides clarity for the team, for the guys succeeding him. I think it was a good call.
I think
smart.
So, too. And, you know, a lot of the, even just the stories he shared about those 36 hours were pretty interesting. How, you know, he went to the sideline under his own power, obviously. He fell down, but then he hop-walked over to the sideline where the trainers looked at him. And he said, honestly, like, I thought it was the type of injury where I could have just ran it off on the sideline for a few minutes, and if it was a regular season game, I would have tried to go back in. So he said he was really, really thankful that obviously it wasn't a regular season game, because if he had tried to go back in and play on a torn ACL, even though he didn't know it was a torn ACL, who knows what other internal damage he could have done to his knee or even other parts of his leg. So it was he was very fortunate in some senses. And the other anecdote he shared that was interesting is that the news was broken to him before halftime. You know, that he didn't have an MRI, obviously, because they were in the locker room. But he said that the training staff told him the overwhelming likelihood was a torn ACL, and he would find out for sure the next day. So he knew about this by halftime, and he said he was glad he didn't find out on the sideline, because his emotions in those first few seconds after they told him, he said, would not have been something he would want people to see, understandably so.
All right, Mike, you've been through an ACL as a high school athlete, soccer.
It was actually, I tore it this summer going into my senior year of college. So it was in college. And I did not know that I had torn it at the time. I had had three previous knee surgeries before that, so I was sort of familiar with some of the feelings and symptoms you get when you have a significant knee problem. But I was actually in Fort Lauderdale at the time. I was an intern for the Sun Sentinel, the main newspaper in Fort Lauderdale. And I didn't really know that I had done anything. It was actually, well, believe it or not, I was working when I actually tore the ACL, which I've gone back and pinpointed as the date. I was writing a story about a mixed martial arts fighter, and he had asked me whether or not I would be interested in coming to train with him one day to see what it was actually like. So I said, yeah, of course, that'll be a great story. So I went to his house. He was showing me some of the basics of jiu-jitsu and grappling and things like that. And in one particular position, he just put a little bit too much pressure. It was by no means an intense session. It was just a fluky thing where he put a little bit too much pressure on my back, and I felt a very small pop in my knee. But as someone who had had knee surgeries, my knees have cracked and popped for years. So I didn't really make anything out of it. I went home. There wasn't a lot of swelling. It felt great a couple days later. And so I resumed playing weekly basketball games with some of the writers in Miami. I think I played maybe two or three times down at a high school in Miami. And the third time, about an hour into it, nothing particular happened, like where I blew it out the way Jordy did. But all of a sudden, I could not jump. I couldn't get any lift off the ground. Something was very, very wrong. And so I called my mom back in Connecticut, and I said, can you schedule an appointment with the orthopedic surgeon? So when my internship ended, about a month later, I got back to Connecticut in August. I had an MRI, and they told me that it was just a bad bruise. But you have to go in and see the surgeon so he can show you on the MRI what he sees or doesn't see. And when he actually called me in for a second look at it, he zoomed in and he said, holy cow. And I'll never forget this quote. He said, the inside of your ACL looks like it's been through a paper shredder. So apparently I didn't have a sort of diagonal tear like you would tear a piece of paper in half. But he said the inside of my ACL was totally shredded.
Jeez.
So 4 months later in December, during the semester break between fall and spring for college, I came back to Connecticut and I had a total knee reconstruction where they took about, I think it's 30 centimeters. They take maybe a little bit less, maybe 20 centimeters of your ACL, excuse me, of your hamstring. And they make that into your new ACL. So I've been through it. It is brutal. I'm not going to lie to you. It is an extremely, extremely tough recovery. So all the sympathy I have goes to Jordy because it is a brutal recovery. And again, think of it this way. I had to recover to be able to play pickup basketball. He has to recover to play football in the best league in the world with some of the best physical specimens on the planet. It's a whole different rehab. So it's going to be tough, no question.
Hmm. Boy, thanks for sharing that. That is... So the jiu-jitsu guy applying pressure to your back.
Huh? Yeah, he was behind me, and he was just showing me the different ways you can use tension and leverage to apply pressure. And it was nothing serious. It was just him leaning forward like this.
Yeah.
But I was in a crouched position with my knees at a very tight angle. And when he pushed me forward, I just felt a tiny little tweak or pop. And then I pinpointed that as probably the moment where it first happened.
Okay. Holy smokes.
Yeah. But aside from Jordy, we've got some other injuries we need to talk about. I mean, the O-line is it's a murderer's row right now, honestly. We've got David Bakhtiari, left tackle, out. We've got Josh Sitton, left guard, out. We've got TJ Lang, right guard, out. And filling in for him are unproven guys, a guy that changed position. And, you know, what's going on with that group right now that looked like a major point of strength going into this season?
You know... I mean, who cares about these games, right? Okay. And Bakhtiari and Sitton both guaranteed they will be ready for the Bear game. Lang, he will have had 21 days, right, to recover from this concussion. We haven't seen Lang this week. We're taping this Thursday morning. Don't know about Lang. We don't know what to say about him.
And for a point of reference, every concussion is different, but Jared Aberderis suffered a concussion on the first day of camp. It is more than 21 days later, and we have not seen him back on the field. So just because he has 21 days is no guarantee whatsoever that he will be ready to go. Everyone heals differently from concussions based on severity and individual body type.
True. You know, Lang, when you look at that tape, I don't really know when he suffered that concussion.
It almost seemed to me from watching it that it might have been a buildup of a few different hits that he took rather than one crunching blow the way we saw with Tolzien, you know?
Mm-hmm. And then he just kind of took his helmet off and walked off.
Yeah. Really slow. Really slow walk off the field, too.
So in this exhibition game, right, Mike?
Exhibition.
Not preseason.
No, it's not a preseason game. It's an exhibition game.
It really, truly is an exhibition.
Yep.
It's a and glorified scrimmage.
If you believe Julius Peppers, as I wrote in today's paper, it is a glamorized practice where there's live tackling and we keep score.
Old Pepper, that's a pretty good one.
That's a pretty good quote. A glamorized practice where there's live tackling and we keep score.
But one thing interesting, that crowd at, I keep thinking Three River Stadium. What's the name of the place in Pittsburgh?
Heinz Field.
They announced it at 44,000. It now seats 68. They added 3,000 or 3,500 this year in that, what would it be, the Riverside end zone.
Mm-hmm.
How many really were there?
Boy.
Tom and I were talking about this. A little more than half?
Yeah, I would say 35 tops.
Yeah.
It was very empty.
80 degrees, perfect weather. Afternoon, I mean, Sunday afternoon, that's not a hardship for anybody. Nobody went. Now, will anybody be there for the Eagle game Saturday night? Oh, yeah.
Yeah, absolutely.
It'll probably be, you know, they'll sell 80,000, and it'll probably be 72, 74 will show up, I would imagine, which is an amazing throng for an exhibition game. Only in Green Bay, seriously.
Only in Green Bay.
Pretty much that's the case.
And it doesn't even look like they're going to see much of Aaron Rodgers, does it?
Might not see any, right, Mike?
It might not see any. Rodgers seems to... From what Rodgers said, and our colleague Tom Silverstein wrote about this in today's paper, he seemed to think that in a perfect world he wouldn't play at all. That was sort of what I took away from his comments. Hmm. I think the reality is that Mike McCarthy thinks he probably needs one series. That's my guess. One series for Rodgers. What do you think?
I do think he will start and play one series just because he wants to have a little bit of exposure with the Montgomery Cobb Adams line, you know?
But does he just hand it off three times and they go three and out and he's safe? No injury?
I think they put him in the shotgun. They chip on Barkley's side.
With Lacy, which we saw once or twice.
And he just throws hitches and a couple bubble screens and maybe a wide stick, and he doesn't look downfield, really, and that's it. The Eagles, Billy Davis is a former Packer assistant. He's their defensive coordinator. And he was an assistant here in 2000, Mike Sherman's first year, defensive assistant. And he's been a coordinator with the Niners, Arizona, and now in the Eagles. And he did a press conference in Philly this week. And he got his nose rubbed in it here at Lambeau Field in November, 53-20. Pathetic showing by those Eagles.
I watched that game on TV, actually, at the time. Yep.
And Billy was asked about it, and he's a really good guy. And he mentioned basically getting it handed to him. You don't think he's not talking to his players about that?
Oh,
you
yeah.
Bet he is. Exhibition or not, nobody wants to give up 53.
No question.
And he's
no
coming
question.
Back to that same field. 10 months later, that's a red flag if you're Mike McCarthy. I'm telling you that right now. Mike McCarthy has coached with Billy Davis. He knows Billy Davis. He knows Billy's not going to really be out there with handing out greeting cards and taking another shot to the head. Dangerous situation. You got Barkley, 3 sacks, 6 pressures, 2 holding penalties. He has shown right now that he can't play tackle. The Packers can't play him at tackle. If everybody was healthy, I think they'd want to be looking at Josh Walker at left tackle just to see this week. But they can't. You know, they need Walker at guard. So
it's a tough spot.
And Tolzien's not there. It's a real tough spot for Hundley and Blanchard, Mike?
Let's say you get one series from Rodgers. Then the Eagles are going to play their starters more than one series on the defense. You know they are.
Probably going to go a half.
So that means you get to see one Brett Hundley and or one Matt Blanchard against a starting defense for their first game in Lambeau. It's going to be – I think it could be ugly. I don't mean injury-wise necessarily. I just think that there might not be much offensive production from the Packers on Saturday.
Maybe it'll be 53-20 the other way.
Oh,
huh?
Boy, that would be something.
An exhibition tilt.
An exhibition tilt. What's the spread? Are we betting on this? What's the over-under? Oh,
yeah.
Man. So what do you think? Hundley took reps ahead of Blanchard yesterday in terms of team reps. It went, Rodgers 1, Hundley 2, Blanchard 3. Tolzien did not practice this week, so he's not playing. You know, even if he were to magically recover by tomorrow, he's still not going to play on Saturday. It's a good opportunity for Hundley and these guys to because they're going to play with the ones, and they got to develop connection with new receivers. I mean, what are you looking for from the new receivers? What do you think they're going to line up in? You know, the Packers use that 11 personnel so much in their offense. You know, one tight end, one running back, 3 wide receivers. Who do you think that third receiver is going to be for the first time on Saturday?
Well, Montgomery.
Yeah, that's what I think too. Even though it's on the edge. Some people think it'll just be Janis because Janis is that guy that fits the edge physical description.
Yeah, I get it. Okay, but he's so much better than Janis right now.
Agreed.
Somehow they just got to make it work with those three people starting out. And then Janis and White, you know. I don't know what I'm going to be looking for. What's meaningful without Rodgers playing with these guys?
What's meaningful without 60% of the offensive line to block for those guys?
Yes, sir.
Oh, man, it is tough. It is tough.
Exhibition football.
Exhibition football.
Pay the full freight for this one. Yep.
Now, the injury bug does not stop there. we saw yesterday after practice one Alonzo Harris with a giant ice wrap on his right hand. It was, you know, officially announced to us as a hand injury. I spoke to him a little bit in the locker room, and he said it's a specific finger on his right hand that got jammed while he was doing pass protection. Basically, he went to put his hands on a defender, and one of his fingers just jammed. He said he messed it up pretty good. That was his phrase. I messed it up pretty good. I asked him if he thought it was broken. He laughed and said, no, I don't think it's broken. But it begs the question, how effective can he be this weekend? How much can they count on him to do anything beyond special teams? And in a running back situation where he is one of three players really competing for that number three spot, these are important reps for him, especially because at the end of last week and in the game against the Steelers, he was atop that number three depth chart, so to speak. There was Harris 1, Rajon Neal 2, and Crockett 3 in terms of the way they entered into the game. And Harris told me that, they had said to him, this is your chance to get a few more reps, and we're pleased with what you've done. What have you seen from Alonzo Harris? He's a big physical guy.
Yeah, he is. He's better than I thought he was. He never gained 1,000 yards at Louisiana Lafayette. Kind of surprising. He played in a power scheme down there. He said he played a lot on third down. I think he has pretty good hands until the Steeler game when he dropped a pair. He's a better football player than I thought. Now, is he good enough to keep? He's a 4.65 guy. I don't really know yet if he's good enough to keep, although ditto for Neal and Crockett. But of those three, I'd go Neal and Harris tied and Crockett 3.
Agreed. And you mentioned you thought he had pretty decent hands. He thought the same thing, even though that was one of the knocks on him entering training camp. He said people questioned two things, his pass protection and his ability to catch out of the backfield. Now, he did have two really, really bad drops against the Steelers, and he was extremely hard on himself for those plays in the locker room. He said he let himself down, let his team down. He said he thought he took two steps back with his performance on offense. But when I talked to him yesterday, so that would have been, Wednesday, he said that every pass since that game he has caught in practice. He hasn't had a single drop. Now, obviously, I haven't watched every play. I don't know if he's telling me the truth. But it seemed like a guy who had really said to himself, I need to focus this week. And at least from his brief report yesterday, it sounds like he did that. Another thing he's pleased with is his special teams play. He's an important special teams player right now for the Packers. They're giving him looks on 3 out of the 4 core units. The only one he said he wasn't on against the Steelers was kickoff coverage, but he was on punt return, and kick return. And he said he graded out, quote, very, very well, end quote, from the coaches with his special teams play. So even though he wasn't pleased with the way he caught the football, he thinks he's making an impression in other areas. And, it's the age-old adage. These young players need to make their mark on special teams. So maybe that's a point of emphasis for him that's going in the positive direction. But I agree with you. I think it's Harrison, Neal, 1 and 2, and Crockett behind. Now, would that have changed if Crockett was healthy from the beginning of camp? Who knows? But he wasn't. He missed a chunk of practice, and I think he's definitely in that third spot.
All right, let's go to Neal. Of the three, Neal is the fastest. He's probably has the most wiggle, the most elusiveness, the most explosion. I mean, he looks like a real back who could, carry it. He's 220. He's got nice size, and he's got pretty good speed. The question on him, is really toughness. He was a wide receiver early in his career at Tennessee. And the toughness knock was a little bit of it was evident yesterday in the one-on-one blitz pickup drill. They don't do it very much. Extremely physical. We don't know if Harris hurt his hand during this drill or in another part of practice. My suspicion is he hurt it in this drill. It was physical. You got inside backers against the 7 running backs, and everybody who's not in that rep, just jammed in there, screaming and hollering and things. So it gets pretty intense. And Neal got run over on his first 2 reps. You do not want to show weakness in this drill.
Do you remember who hit him? I wasn't able to watch that drill.
45, Josh Francis, who really has been a bottom of the 90-man roster inside backer. He took out all his frustrations in this drill. I don't have my listing here. But he destroyed Neal once, and then he destroyed maybe Crockett later. And he's Francis looked really good in this thing.
He's a player who's gotten destroyed himself a few times in camp. He's taken some real big licks on special teams and in the half line drill. Right. So good for him to dish it out to somebody
else. He went hammering here, boy. He was hunting. Then Neil, to his credit, you know, he bounced back and he had a tie and a victory. So, I mean, he really saved some face. Now let's go to Crockett, okay? The guy who set all those records from North Dakota State, from Minneapolis, what is it, Totino High School, I think. John had a high ankle sprain in one of the last practices in OTA in mid-June. Didn't return till about a week into camp. Wasn't it, Mike? Something like that?
Yeah, he definitely. I think he missed about a week. I might have even pegged him for 8 or 10 days. So it was a lengthy start to the season. And he was on PUP, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I don't really know. I got to think he has more burst than what we've seen. I mean, I wonder if the ankle is really, you know, enabling him to show what he totally has. But be that as it may, after Harris dropped out of this drill, Crockett was taking almost every other rep at the end. There was 20 reps in all, rapid fire. It was interesting. And Crockett held up okay. I had him for 2 wins, 1 defeat, and a couple of draws. But as you say, as we agree, Crockett, somehow he's got to show more burst, but he just can't make it at this point at this speed.
Well, now let's move to the fullbacks a little bit there.
How do you see that, Mike?
Well, you've got two guys that are, in many ways, I think, kind of similar, even though they're, you know, a decade apart in age, roughly. You've got John Kuhn, the veteran who has done so much for this team, and both on special teams and in the fullback role for the offense. And then you've got Aaron Ripkowski, this guy that, first of all, great football name, Ripkowski. That's the kind of name you want back there. Second of all, he just is an absolute ball hawk on special teams. It seems like he has no regard for his body whatsoever. He just slices down the field on kickoff, punt coverage, anything, and just makes tackles, makes tackles, makes tackles. Now, Ron Zook, the special teams coordinator, did say yesterday that a couple of those tackles originated on plays where he was totally out of position and just went straight for the ball instead of filling his assignment, following the lane he's supposed to be in, and then going to the ball. But the fact of the matter is the guy gets the tackle, and he makes the play. And I think that's really impressed people so far. At least for me, we haven't seen so much of them in the actual exhibition games because they haven't used a lot of tight end until the Pittsburgh game, actually. The very first possession, the Packers didn't use a tight end at all. It was all John Kuhn up and down the field. But other than that, we haven't seen a whole lot of them in the actual scope of the offense. But man, Ripkowski's toughness impresses me. I don't know about you.
It manifested itself in the blitz pickup drill, Mike. On the second rep, Kuhn leads it off, stones somebody. Ripkowski's up next. He's got Clay Matthews 2-3 yards away from him, coming in from an inside backer. He's got a two-way go. He can go left, right, or right through you, you know. It's a pretty tough drill. Ripkowski stoned his butt.
Really?
Yeah. Bent the knees. I mean, he got the hands inside on Clay Matthews. He just jacked him. I mean, it was just no movement. He just locked him up at the line.
What was the reaction from everybody around? Was there hooting and hollering on that one?
Yeah, there was. There definitely was. And it really opened my eyes. And then about 10 reps later, he defeated somebody. I don't know, Tavares Dantzler, I believe.
Okay. What do you think about his playing time relative to Kuhn?
Crazy. Why wasn't Rip? They know John Kuhn, right?
Yeah.
There's nothing more John Kuhn can tell this coaching staff for an evaluation.
Correct.
So Kuhn's out there. McCarthy wants to get that 3-4 off the field, and he gets the Steelers into that nickel right off the bat to avoid some of the crazy fire zone blitzing stuff. All works good. He's got a 2-back with 3-wide all the way down the field. Why doesn't Ripkowski, after 4 or 5 snaps, insert Ripkowski?
I don't get it either.
Mike, Ripkowski, then after that, then Tolzien comes in, and they get into their basic 1-back, 1-tight, 3-wide. Ripkowski plays 2 snaps in the entire game, and on both plays he delivers effective blocks.
Aside from special teams, you mean, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
2 snaps from scrimmage.
I don't get it.
No, I don't either.
I don't either. It doesn't make any sense to me, but I think they like him. I think they do. I don't know what's not to like about the guy.
So maybe they keep the 2 fullbacks and three halfbacks.
That's what I'm thinking.
Maybe they keep only 4 running backs total.
1 on the practice squad?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Just keep 4 because you got Kuhn who can swing.
That's true.
That could happen.
That's true.
If they're going to keep 3 QBs, which we're assuming they will.
I think they will, because I think they want to keep Hundley, and Tolzien is the backup.
Although if Hundley has another performance like he did in Pittsburgh...
Ooh, he looked rough.
People may not claim him, and they may think they can get him on the practice squad then.
Explain that a little bit. What do you mean by that?
Okay, Green Bay has had two QBs for about the last 4 years, I believe. They stopped keeping three, and then they put a third on the practice squad, generally. Not always. Okay, Hundley, he's a fifth-round pick. Some people before that draft told me he was like a second or a third on their board. So we know a lot of those people still like Brett Hundley. Okay, in New England, he looked good.
Yes, he did.
You cannot be cutting that guy and expect him to clear waivers on August 31st. What's the date? September 2, I guess it is the final cut. Clear waivers, go on your practice squad, and not get claimed before he goes on the practice squad. But he did not look good in only 11 plays at Pittsburgh. He held the ball. He had a terrible intentional grounding. Didn't have much help. Now, that offense was a complete, mess at that point. But it wasn't impressive. So people around this league are all devouring those tapes, those 30-plus snaps on Hundley. Now we'll see what he does against the Eagles ones, right?
Against the Eagles ones in his first game in a stadium that is going to be a rocking atmosphere, I would think, Saturday night. Mm-hmm. I think people are going to be excited for that. What do you think? Do you think he bounces back with a solid performance? What's your hunch on his play?
He hasn't had much time with these ones.
I know.
He's used to playing with these twos and threes. So he doesn't have any timing, really, very little with Lacy, the running backs. He doesn't really know these offensive linemen. I remember I asked Lindsley or somebody the other day, one of the starting offensive linemen, about Hundley. He said, well, I really can't say. He says, I'm not in there with him that much, It's a tough spot. It's a great opportunity, as Coach Mike McCarthy likes to say.
Yes.
Opportunity, Mike.
Next man up, Bob.
It's all about opportunity. And I don't know how he's going to do. I have no idea.
I'm interested to see a little bit more of what Blanchard can do.
Hmm.
I don't think he really has a chance to make this team at this point. But he also has gotten the short end of the stick in both exhibition games in terms of number of reps and things like that. I'm just kind of interested to see if he gets maybe 4, 5, 6 series, how he looks in there. Because there were points in training camp where he threw the ball very, very well. And if he can settle into a game and doesn't have to worry about winding the clock down in the final 4 minutes of the fourth quarter, I'm just kind of curious to see how he throws it.
To win a game right now, Michael Cohen, would you rather line up with Mr. Hundley or Mr. Blanchard?
A full four-quarter game?
You got it. Regular season.
Blanchard, what do you think?
I'm going with the UCLA youngin.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
All right. He can run around, I think.
He can run around.
Yep.
That is true. Blanchard's more of that drop back kind of guy. Let's see. What else do we got on the agenda? Oh, I had a story in today's paper that you were a little skeptical about, Mr.
I was
McGinn.
Leery, no doubt.
You were a little skeptical. I approached you yesterday in the locker room, and I said, Bob, I've got this idea. And Bob said, you jerk. That is a terrible
no,
idea.
No, I didn't.
No, he didn't. He didn't. But he said, I don't know. Why don't you see what happens with it, and we'll talk about
it. We'll talk later.
We'll talk about it. So the idea was, I had stumbled upon the fact that Kennard Backman, a sixth-round pick, a rookie from UAB, has a very interesting hobby that he has sort of taken to the next level. Mr. Backman is a barber. He started cutting hair when he was a senior in high school, and he expanded so that he ran his own little informal barbershop in college with his roommate at UAB. And he wants to open his own barbershop whenever football comes to a close. And in Green Bay, in the locker room, he started cutting hair for a lot of the guys in the room. He'll charge them between $10 and $20, and sometimes more if they give a little bit of a tip. And he cuts hair for the likes of Jayron Elliott, Mike Pinnell, Adrian Hubbard, Jimmy Hunt, Tay Glover Wright, Ty Montgomery, the list goes on. So I put together a story about his sort of hobby here, and you came into my apartment this morning and you said you actually liked it.
The seedlings of Backman's secondary endeavor were born of teenage frugality in suburban Atlanta. I like those kind of sentences.
I like that sentence too. I was happy with that one. But yeah, Backman's this guy that basically, he was going to the barber shop a lot because him and his high school teammates would go basically every 2 weeks to look fresh for their high school football games. And his mom finally said, look, you're getting between 24 and 36 haircuts a year. Enough of that. Enough of that. You know, you can pay for it. And when he started dishing out his own cash, he said, enough of this. I'll become a barber. And so he started learning. He talked about how he learned the differences between fine hair and coarse hair and hair for light-skinned people and hair for dark-skinned people. And he's even experimenting with the old-school straight razor, which actually I was surprised. I told you about that once when I was looking for a barber up here. And you've never had the back of your neck trimmed with a straight razor,
no,
have you?
No, you have. Huh?
It's super old-school, super old-school. But it's the closest way to get your sideburns and the back of your neck trimmed. I asked Jimmy Hunt, who was the first person whose hair he cut here in Green Bay, if he would trust Backman with the straight razor. And he goes, oh, no, that's a deep cut. I'll have to give him a chance on that one. That's a deep cut.
So, Mike, pray tell, how did you find out about Mr. Backman's avocation?
Well, in the media guide, they actually have little bios for every player. And at the bottom of it is a little personal section. And I always try and read those just to see, you know, what details they're willing to share about their lives. And usually they only share things that they really are interested in or really enjoy. And one of the first things in there about Backman said that he liked cutting hair. And I said, okay, well, maybe that's just a nugget. Maybe he just cuts his own hair, which he does, by the way. He cuts his own hair.
Really?
He really does.
Wow.
Yeah.
Okay.
But when I asked him about it, it turned into an actual business venture story, and I just thought it was kind of interesting to get a little feature angle on a guy who you know, Packer fans have been interested in since he was a draft pick.
Good story.
Good story.
Yep.
Thank you. Now, I understand that at one point this week you were looking through some of your files, and you came across something kind of interesting here. What have you got for us?
I was checking back on the people who suffered season-ending injuries in exhibition games.
Which was a great and really smart story, by the way.
Thanks, Mike.
A testament to your record-keeping.
So, Mike, I went back to 1986, 30 years ago. I figured we have a nice even number. And I was looking at my clips. And I came across an exhibition game at Riverfront Stadium in Cincinnati, the Queen City, I think it is, yeah.
Maybe.
August 23rd, 1986. Third game in 86, and Forrest Gregg was going back to Cincinnati, the coach GM of the Packers, and he had led the Bengals to the Super Bowl in 81, and the day before in the Cincinnati Post, the headline said, Forrest Gregg, a legend returns. On the sports page, there was another headline, Sam who? Gregg still is king here. Who's Sam, Mike?
I don't know. You think you stumped me.
Sam Weish, his successor as head coach.
Okay.
All right. And then it's a story on Forrest's return included the line, he is not only remembered, he is revered. So Forrest rode into Riverfront that night. He was coming off a dreadful showing against the Giants down in Milwaukee. Lost that one in horrible fashion. So he wanted to play well. Back in front of his old pals, right? A crowd of 44,000 at Riverfront, and they saw the Bengals win that one 34-12. Forrest exploded. He vilified his defense for his showing in the second half. He said his players laid down when the Bengals put up 251 yards and 24 points in the second half. Even when we had our starters in, they ran over us, through us, around us, underneath us, and they threw on us at will, Gregg fumed. That was the lousiest defensive performance in the second half I think I've ever seen any football team give out. They completely quit. I don't know whether there's anybody on that defense at all that really cares whether they played football or not.
Wow.
But I'll tell you this right now. It won't be hard to cut them. But I can't cut them all. How about Forrest? Then he seemed to soften. He says, I know it's just an exhibition game, but I get ticked off and excited. I just don't like to ever play this poorly. I enjoyed coming back to Cincinnati, but I didn't enjoy coming back and getting my tail kicked. Well, Mike, he got his tail kicked the rest of that year. That was after 2-8-8 seasons, his first two campaigns in Green Bay, 84 and 85. Forrest decided, no, we have to shuffle the deck. 8-8's not good enough. And he gutted the roster, got rid of a whole bunch of veterans who had put up a lot of points for about 5 or 6 years, and proceeded to go 4-12. Probably the worst team I ever covered here in Green Bay. And Forrest was gone a year later.
Can you picture McCarthy giving that kind of a reaction to a game? Could he do it?
So if the Eagles destroy the Packers Saturday night, which we're both speculating. It's impossible to do in these exhibition tilts that it could happen, right? What would the head coach of the Packers saying after a rip job?
Boy, I don't know. I think it depends. If the young quarterback's performed poorly, I think he can kind of couch it a little bit and say that, you know, Hundley and Blanchard are young guys. But if that defense comes out and plays poorly, I don't know. Maybe he's got a little Forrest in him. Maybe he no? You don't think so?
No, I remember. Now, Mike, it comes back to me. I wrote this very same thing about 2 or 3 years ago after a terrible exhibition game, and I went back to some stuff Greg had said in 87, I believe, and how he ran training camp. No, McCarthy just brushed it off and went on and about his schedule, you know? And that's the wise way to do it, but it's not the fun way to do it.
It's not the fun way.
No.
I remember once I was covering a game in Syracuse. Obviously, it wasn't an exhibition game because college football teams don't have exhibition games. But Scott Schaefer, the defensive coordinator who then became the head coach after Doug Marrone went on to the NFL, he was so furious after a game. And he was always – he's the type of guy that couldn't calm down between the time the game ended and the time he spoke to the media. So any emotion he had was still there. He couldn't stifle it yet. He actually broke the podium. He slammed it with his hand and pieces of wood broke off, and it became a joke for a little while that he was going to break the podium. I remember it was in the Carrier Dome, and he was slamming his hand and screaming and, you know, banging on the table, and he broke a piece off the podium. I was impressed. Yeah. But that's one of the more physical fiery examples I've seen from a coach. But I think you're right. I don't think McCarthy has it in him.
Unfortunately, in the NFL, we get bland, and blander, you know?
It seems that way.
Just garbage time at the podium. It's what it is. It's what the sport has evolved into.
I think we've reached garbage time of this podcast. we've run out of our topics here for this week. We appreciate you listening, as always. And we'll be back with one more exhibition game to talk about after Saturday night.
Thanks for calling them what they are, Mike.
You
appreciate
got it.
Thanks for listening.
You got it. See you next time, guys.